we're going to talk about Hebrews 11 again. Matt, rather large area dealing with our friend Abraham. We move to one verse to deal with his son Isaac. I always think it's going to be interesting when we get to heaven to talk to Isaac. Because although he's involved in some things, he doesn't ever seem to be the center of attention. He's the first son. He's the son of the promise. He's the one, Abraham's son, his only son whom he loved, that he offered on, in his mind offered on Mount, on the area of Moriah. And then he's the one who's going to, if anything, his biggest mistake, his biggest sin of sorts is recorded in the next part. And yet he doesn't get castigated for it. It's actually talking about his offering or his blessing by faith. Or in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 20. And what we're going to look at is something that I think has to do with something called providence. Something that people used to talk about centuries ago. I did a lot of my doctoral work in the Great Awakening. That was what it was about. And those people love that word, providence. In fact, if you remember that when a guy named Roger Williams came to this country and he decided he was a Baptist and not a Congregationalist, a Congregationalist there. He went down into Rhode Island and founded a city. It's called Providence. And that wasn't by accident. It was providential. But he founded a city named Providence. It was so important in the thinking of these people, and I think it should be more important in our thinking. Now, some people have a problem with providence, because they can't wrap their minds around the Bible teaching about God, his eternity, his omniscience, his omnipotence, that means he can do anything he wants, his sovereignty, that means he rules over all things. They have trouble concerning conceiving of a God who has no beginning and no end. God is far greater than we can begin to understand. And a lot of the heresies that have come over the years have come from people who tell you to take the great big God that exists and make him smaller than he is. And we can't let them do that, because if we do, then we don't serve the true and living God. But they stumble over the reality of God's ability to do anything he wants to do. Most of all, they can't allow God to be sovereign over all that he has created. I had a real temptation when I wrote that part of this to go to Daniel 4. I was telling my wife on the way home today, I remember a quiz. I think it was in seminary. It might have been in Bible college. But the quiz was this. Name the only Gentile author in the Bible. And what he wanted was Luke. Because the reason we bought it was I preached on Acts this morning. Of course, Luke wrote that. Luke was not a disciple. He was a converted man. He was a Gentile doctor that got saved through the ministry of the Apostle Paul. And he ministered to the Apostle Paul. And he wrote the book of Luke, and he also wrote the book of Acts. And so there's some people say, well, he's the only Gentile author in the Bible. And so I put in there, well, you're looking for is Luke. But the fact is, Nebuchadnezzar wrote almost the entire fourth chapter of the book of Daniel. You get in there, remember Daniel, he talks about this dream. And Daniel comes out, and he talks about this is what happened. And that's actually Nebuchadnezzar's writing a lot of that. It's his testimony. All this happened, and then he ended up those 7 years as an ox. And then God gave him his sanity back, gave him his kingdom back, which was nothing short of a miracle. If you follow the kings of that day, you realize that just didn't happen, but it did because God made it happen. And when he got done, he wrote this little thing in the end of it. After he tells his story, in the end of it, he writes this thing saying, this is what I learned about the sovereignty of God. And if you read through that, the dominion of God, that's what he called it. But you read through that, you realize God said a couple times through the angel of the Lord that I am doing this to you, Nebuchadnezzar, so that you will learn this lesson. And that you, basically, that you learn it, God is providentially in control of all things. And so I think that applies to this. But we're going to see all this. We're going to see the providence of God in action and described here in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 20. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning the things to come. Very short verse, very long backstory that every Jew who was hearing what the writer of Hebrews was writing and it was being read to them immediately knew the whole story. And you may too, but we're just going to talk about that story. Before I start, I want to say something because I'm just as sure as I'm standing here, I'm not going to remember to say it. When we talk about God's sovereignty and His providence, God controls all things. He can rule and overrule when it comes to our sin. But God is never responsible for our sin, nor is He responsible for our stupid actions. None of those things frustrate Him. None of those things surprise Him. He can rule and overrule in those situations. But don't make the mistake that God somehow causes you to sin. And I say that because every time I preach on something like this, somebody comes over and says to me, "You know, I'm glad you preached on that because now I know that God allowed me or made me sin. Or God's responsible for my sin." I've had that a couple times in a couple of different churches. And I have to sit down and say, no, that's not what I said. That's not what it says. He overrules and overrules our sin. He has His way in spite of our sin. Our sin cannot frustrate His plan. However, our sin is never His will, and you can't blame God for your sin. I could give you lots of illustrations. I won't. Trust me, that's true. Circumstances of the blessing and how this blessing, how the blessing was done by faith. We're going to try to explain all the things that happened, then we're going to go back and explain how verse 11:20 of Hebrews works. So before we do that, let's ask the Lord to help us, and then we'll try to kind of cover a lot of territory. Let's pray. Father, we are very thankful for the privilege of having the Word of God again, having pictures of people that believed You, trusted in You, and showed us that we can trust You too. Pray that You would help us not only just to learn from maybe a famous person like Abraham, but also from a relatively insignificant one as we think about the Bible and the person of Isaac. Thank You for him. Thank You for the fact that he by and large walked with You, and that sometimes he, like all of us, are prone to sin and do our own thing instead of doing what You want. Pray that we learn from his mistakes, but also recognize the wonder of his example. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. We're going to talk about first the circumstances. This whole story is in Genesis 27. Before you get there, though, you need to take a stop on the way in Genesis 25, verses 23 through 26, which tells us about the birth of Jacob and Esau. Remember, Rebekah, like Rachel before, not Rachel, like, what's his mother's name? Isaac's mother. Sarah. Sarah was barren. Rebekah's barren. She can't have children. She keeps saying to Jacob, "Give me children." And he says, "Who am I, God?" And of course, you know, I think that's included so we understand that the kind of spattering sometimes we do as husbands and wives also happened back in those days. But in Genesis 25, Isaac prayed for Rebekah and she conceived. And when she was giving birth, she realized she was having twins. And here's the record. And the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb. Two people shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." I'll read that part again. "The older shall serve the younger." So when her days were fulfilled for her to give birth, indeed, there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red, and he was like hair. He was like a hairy garment all over. So they called his name Esau. They called him Red. Surprise, surprise. Afterward, his brother came out, and his hand took hold of Esau's heel, and so his name was called Jacob. That was his name, Jacob. Creative ways to find names, but that's the names that they had. And we're going to find Jacob means a lot of things. Usually means crooked and all that kind of stuff. Not a nice name to give your kid, but he got that. We see from this that from their birth, Jacob and Esau's future was determined. It's already stated. God had said to Rebekah, the older is going to serve the younger. It is not going to be like it normally was, that the older son, the firstborn, inherited all the stuff. That he actually, it's going to be the secondborn. And then the big discussion that all us intelligent people who lived many centuries later have is, well, did Rebekah tell Isaac? And the answer is yes, I think she did. I think it's unthinkable, given any knowledge of Middle Eastern culture, that she wouldn't. And I think if she hadn't told him, I think we would have been told, because it's very key to what's going to happen in Genesis 27. But in Genesis 27, verses 1 to 4, this is many years later. These are not young men. These are men that have just stayed home. There's a calculation you can do if you look at the lives and the genealogies that comes up with, like, they were 77 years old when this happens. I don't know if that's, it's been a long time since I've done that. I won't stake my reputation on that, but they were not young men. We always get this picture, they're like teenagers. They weren't. They were far old enough, far more than old enough to know what they were doing. But in Genesis 27, 1 to 4, we find the account of what took place in this blessing process. And you find that although God has determined ahead of time what would do Isaac, what should happen, Isaac has his own idea. So we read, "Now it came to pass when Isaac was old and his eyes were so dim that he couldn't see," I know something about that condition, "that he called Esau, his older son, and said to him, 'My son,' and he answered, 'Here am I.' Then he said, 'Behold, now I am old. I do not know how the day of my death,'" which, by the way, was going to be many years later, at least 20 years. He didn't know that. "I don't know the day of my death. Now, therefore, please take your bows, your weapons, your quiver and your bow, and go out into the field and hunt game for me and make me savory food," that means spicy food, "such as I love, and I will, and bring it to me that I may eat, that my soul may bless you before I die." Now, we might say, how could Isaac do this? Some say, well, Isaac didn't know, or Isaac forgot what was told. I think there's lots of things. I have a speculation in there, and it's speculation. I hate to preach speculation. But he might have convinced himself, since the family blessing, which he was giving out, the heritage blessing, was something that was in the domain of the father, not in the domain of the mother, that he had the right to bless anybody he wanted to. And frankly, if you and I were in Isaac's sandals, we guys, I don't know if girls would identify with this as much, but we guys, Isaac was a man's man, and so was Esau. I mean, Esau was a hairy man. Esau was a man of the field. He hunted, and he went out, and he worked out in the field. He was Mr. Man. You know, he was the cover of Field and Stream. He was just the epitome of what a man should be. And then there was Jacob. He was smooth, and he was mama's boy. And so we look at those two. I think it's important we realize this, because if you were in Isaac's shoes, you would try to find a way to do what Isaac did. That's a natural thing to do. This wasn't Isaac just said, "I'm going to rebel against God. He said, "Do I have to bless this mama's boy? Can I give it to Esau?" So you see that process. But here's the process: you go out, you get the food, and when you come back, I'll eat it, and then I'll bless you. His blessing Esau was in direct opposition to God's command. Esau was not pure in the situation either. He had sold his birthright, remember? He came in and he was hungry, and brother Jacob, mama's boy, was cooking. I cook, so I think I can. He was cooking. You don't have to be a mama's boy to cook, but he was cooking and he made some lentil stew. And of all things, Esau sold his birthright for lentil stew, which shows you how much he really appreciated his birthright. So in a real sense, this blessing shouldn't have been Esau's at all. Because not only did God say it wasn't supposed to be his, Esau sold it. But he didn't bother to tell his dad that. "No, now you're going to bless me. Don't bless me because I already sold that." He just says, well, if what Jacob doesn't know, Jay isn't going to hurt him. However, Rebekah knew. She was hiding in the fold somewhere and she heard it. And she... she came up with a scheme. It looks like Jacob came up with his scheming honestly. He knew how to scheme, and he probably learned it from Rebekah. And when you find out Rebekah's brother, Laban, when he goes over there, you find out Laban was even a better schemer than Rebekah was, better schemer than Jacob was. So that's an amazing thing. Now, Rebekah decided to flaunt the will of her husband, not just the will of God, but the will of her husband, and to cook up this tremendous deception to still get the blessing for Jacob that he was supposed to get, her favorite. And you know the story. Now, what's amazing about this, and I think you have to see this, somehow we think Jacob was this angelic guy, you know? But in the middle of this thing, you got to realize Jacob's response to his mother is not, oh, we can't do this. This is terrible. How honest is this, Mom? We can't do that. Let's just go talk to Dad. Tell him he can't do that. She doesn't do that. What he says is, Mom, you haven't thought this all the way through. Esau's hairy. I'm smooth. Esau smells. I don't. Smells like the field. I don't. All those things, you know, you haven't thought this out. This guy's really the bastion of moral integrity, you know. He's just, you know, he's not a bit ashamed of that. He's just concerned that all the details are covered, and Rebecca has thought them out already. She's a lot sharper than he thought he was. So finally, in verses 18 through 27, the deception is carried out. He goes in carrying this meal, I guess goats, cooked in enough spice, tastes like deer, cooked in enough spice. But he comes in with those little goats and the goat skin on his neck and on his arms and Esau's clothes on, and then proceeds to lie his way through this process and get the blessing. Verse 20, you realize how very far he went. But Isaac said to his son, how is it that you have found it so quickly, my son? And he, Jacob, said, because the Lord your God brought it to me. You know, one of the things you're going to find in Exodus is there's a prohibition of using the Lord thy God's name in vain. I think there's no greater example of that than here. God brought it to me. Well, no, he didn't. So not only does Jacob lie, but he implicates God in his lie. The Lord has told me this. The Lord brought this deer to me. That's how come it didn't take very long. Then the blessing is given, and you can read it in verses 27 to 29. And he came near and kissed him. Isaac came near and kissed Jacob. And he smelled the smell of his clothing and blessed him. Now this is Esau's clothing on Jacob, and blessed Jacob and said, surely the smell of my son is like the smell of the field, which the Lord, come on, flip here. The Lord has blessed. Therefore, may God give you of the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine. Let people serve you and nations bow to you. Be master over your brother and let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you and blessed be everyone who blesses you. So he promised Jacob physical blessing and spiritual blessing. Promised Jacob all of these things. We'll come back to this. Then while Jacob leaves Isaac's tent with a taste of victory in his mouth, suddenly here comes Esau. Esau comes in. He's got the deer. He's made it just like Isaac likes it, and finds out that he's been supplanted, that his brothers beat him to the punch. He no longer has the blessing. And you find some interesting that Esau is crushed, so he presses his father and says, at least there's a blessing for me, right? So in verses 39 to 40, we've got the second blessing, which is not anywhere near as nice as the first. Then Isaac his father answered and said to him, behold, your dwelling shall be of the fatness of the earth, and the dew of heaven from above, but by your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother, and it shall come to pass when you become restless that you shall break his yoke from your neck, which of course happened because Esau is the father of the Edomites. Esau marries an Ishmaelite, one of his wives, maybe, and they become, you know, part of the Arabs. Edom has never gotten along with Israel. Lots of problems with it. There's a when later on when we've already seen our friend Nehemiah and Ezra. Ezra, when he's there, this is the time when they're going back to the land, and there's a little, the Judah, which was fairly good, now becomes about that big, and there's a bunch of Edomites that come in, and they become Idumea, Mena, from which you get Herod the Great and the rest of those guys. They're Edomites that have moved into what used to be Judah. That's the situation. So it is true this all happens. Now that we've gotten all those details, now I want to ask this question. I think it's very important we understand it. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 20. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning the things to come. Now we say, how does this blessing, how was it done by faith? We might ask if the record of Genesis 27 is right, and this was all done by deception, how was this done by faith? I think there's two ways, well, the argument against it. In first place, Isaac thought he was blessing someone else, so how could he have blessed, the blessing be legitimate? And then second, Isaac was in a disobedience to the revealed will of God, so how in that world could that be by faith? So to answer this, I think there's two things we have to choose, two ways we have to look at that. First, faith was involved in the nature of the blessing. And that's why it says in the writer of Hebrews, he blessed them concerning things to come. This is really the first manifest. You know, the first promises were given to Abraham. They also were given eventually to Isaac through Abraham. But this is the first time you find the promises that God has given being handed from one person to the next generation. The whole of his heritage, the whole of his legacy are promises. IOUs from God. These things were so real that they handed them out like legacy. This is what you will have. And we look at that and say, well, that's no big deal. That didn't happen. Yeah, but they didn't know it was going to happen. They knew it was going to happen because they had faith, but they didn't know it was going to happen by foresight. They couldn't see down the road anymore than we can. God had promised it, so he gives it on. This is the promise for Jacob. This is a promise for Esau. When Jacob, we're going to read next time, when he blesses the sons of Joseph and those guys, all of those promises were given by faith. Again, you've got the promises of God were so real to them that they could give them out and make them like a will. I leave to you this promise. I leave you to that. And I ask you, and I ask me, how real are the promises of God to you? Are they that real? Would you lose your sanctification over not getting a blessing that involved a promise of something yet to come? And yet he believed it so much, and he felt so strongly about it, he had to bless them before he died. He blessed them concerning things to come. It wasn't something he could touch and see. He could only believe and hand on his faith to them. This is what it was going. It was faith was involved because he believed the promises that God had given Abraham, his father, about the future of his line, and then he gave those promises on to Jacob. He said, God grant you these things. Isaac's mind, the blessings were so real that he could give them to his sons because God would carry them out. Likewise, when he finally, this is the second one, likewise, when he finally gives the blessing to Esau, Isaac knew that these promises and the promises and the prophecies would likewise come true. He had faith that God would also carry out these promises for Esau. Now, you realize when God handed out those promises, he didn't really hand down promises to them for Esau. He handed them down for Jacob. Jacob was the younger. He was supposed to be the one who ruled over the older. But when he gave out his promises to Esau, even the prophecies that he gave, that also was yet to come. He had to believe that God would do it. Second, and this is, I think, the most important reason why it's faith, we find that Isaac's faith also was in his refusal to remove the blessing from the first blessed. I wish I could interview Isaac for you up here and say, okay, Isaac, what was your feeling when you found out it was Jacob you blessed and not Esau? I think you can read that in this text. Genesis 27, 31 to 33 says this. He is Esau. Esau also made savory food and brought it to his father and said to his father, let my father rise and eat of his son's game, that your soul may bless me And his father Isaac said to him, "Who are you?" So he said, "Well, I'm Esau, your son, your firstborn." And then Isaac trembled exceedingly. Isn't that amazing? Isaac trembled. Why did he tremble exceedingly? Well, he was really mad. Don't think so. I think he was really scared. He had decided to defy the statement of God to Rebekah. He had decided he was going to bless the person he wanted to bless, not the one that God wanted to bless. And all of a sudden he began to realize God had changed everything. Now, sure, it was Rebekah's scheme, and Jacob was involved in that scheme, but he recognized that God had overruled. God had interceded. God had said, "This is the one I said to bless, and you blessed him." So he trembled greatly. That's an amazing statement to me. And one of the newer translations says he trembled violently. Anyhow, he trembled, and then he said, "Then Isaac trembled exceedingly and said, 'Who? Where is the one who hunted game and brought it to me? I ate all of it before you came, and I have blessed him, and he shall be blessed, and indeed he shall be blessed.'" I think he realized God had overruled and he was not going to take the blessing away from him. He didn't deserve it. If it wasn't really his, he could have. But Isaac realized it was his and he confirmed it. And I think that was by faith he confirmed it. It was in faithful obedience to what God had said. Now we find Isaac's faith also in his refusal to remove it. Okay. What do we learn from all of this? Well, first we learn that God is able to work out his will and perform it in spite of our determination to do otherwise. Here is my friend Isaac, who I can't wait someday in heaven to get to know him. But anyhow, he's determined, all of a sudden determined. I have this son, this twin, this son who is a man's man, and I have this son who is tied to his mommy's, apron strings, and I'm going to bless the one that I want to bless. So he chooses to do that. And then he realizes that God, the immortal God, interceded, changed the thing around. You never find him, going and saying, "Well, Rebekah pulled a fast one." We don't find that. And you find him saying, "Well, I guess that's what God wanted to do." And I think he was afraid of God when it happened. It was something that God did. God is able to overrule and to accomplish his righteousness in spite of everything else. I think of Job. There's an important thing you need to understand about the book of Job. And I've read countless commentaries, and I've heard, I don't know how many sermons over the years on the book of Job. I've preached a few myself. But I've heard a lot of sermons that have said things like this. Well, when Job, when this stuff happened to Job, Satan did it. Satan sent all these people because God told Job, Satan, "I'm going to take away the hedge of you. Do what you want, just don't kill him." And that's what he did. And so Satan did all this stuff. So we learned this principle, which we don't get this. This is heresy. We learned this principle: when bad things happen to you, it's Satan. When good things happen to you, it's God. Now, I told you that. I'm going to show you the one place that's not true. I think if there's a finest hour for Job, one of them has to be the end of chapter 2, is it? End of chapter 1. You remember how at first there's this confab in heaven and the sons of God, which are the angels, come before the Lord, and among them comes Satan. And God begins to brag about Job. And I don't think Job ever knew anything about this. God begins to brag about Job. There's none like him in any way on planet Earth. He's the best I got. And Job says, if you just take away his hedge, the hedge of protection, he'll curse you and die. And God says, okay, I'll take it away. You can do with him what you want. Just don't kill him. And so he does. So Satan does all this stuff. And you know what happens. Within a short period of time, he's the richest man who ever lived. He becomes the poorest man who's alive. He has nothing. His flocks are gone. his she donkeys are gone. There's something about female donkeys in the Bible. I've not figured this out, but everybody who has a large flock of female donkeys is very rich. Don't know why that is, but he has the flock of she donkeys is gone. All his stock, his livestock, which is his stock market holdings, they're all gone. And not only that, you say, well, at least I have my kids, and then comes this servant, and he comes ragging in, and well, all your kids are in the house, and they're having a big party, and the wind comes, and bang, and they fall in, roof falls in and kills them all. Nobody survived, just me. I'm here to tell you about it. What do you do when that happens? Several years ago, it was really, this is like decades ago, it was really popular, put stress points on things. And somebody wrote an article assigning those stress points to Job. And it's astronomical, the amount of stress points. I mean, everything he owned, everything he had, his whole family, the only thing he had left was his wife. And then, of course, he lost his health, too, in the next chapter. But at the end of chapter 1, this is what Job does. And God is so impressed, it's recorded for us. Job 1, 21 and 22. And I put it in the Old King James because I can't help it. I read the other ones and I still like it best. And Job said, naked I came out. He says he fell on his face and he worshiped God. Job said, naked I came out of my mother's womb, and naked I shall return thither. The Lord gave, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Now before we read the rest of this, the divine commentary on what he said, please note who he said took it all away. It wasn't Satan. You know, that's the only way you're going to get through trial in your life is you recognize that nothing comes into your life that God doesn't allow. Because if you start saying, well, look what Satan did, then Satan's suddenly bigger than God, stronger than God. This is all heresy. This is not in the Bible. And he can do just what he wants, and you just better believe or hope that God gets there first, and maybe God will win. Well, that isn't true. God wins every time. You know from reading Job, if you read Job, that he only could do what God allowed him to do. The point was, people do not suffer because they're evil. Job was not evil. He was incredibly good. He had an incredible relationship with God, and he still suffered. That's the important thing to understand. But the thing that's a comfort to us is Job said, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away, blessed be the name of the Lord. And then God is so impressed, he has to add an editorial comment. And all these things, Job sinned not, nor charged God foolishly. In other words, he didn't charge God with sin. He wasn't lying. God did it. You see, the God who does it, he's the one that's in control, but he's also the one that loves me. And that's the thing that makes this work. And I think that's what's neat about providence, that when all this stuff happens and God rules and overrules and overcomes our sin and deals with his plan, you have to remember in all of this, it is the God who controls all things that is the blessing one. That's why it means so much when you read 13. I love Hebrews 13, 5 and 6. Whenever I get to preach on it, you're going to be so sick of hearing it, you're going to throw up when I go to it. But it's a great statement. Let your lifestyle be without covetousness. Be content with what things you have. For he himself hath said, and he said it many times, and he said it there, and he said it emphatically, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. And then the writer of Hebrews says, therefore we can boldly say, the Lord is my helper, I will not fear. What can man do to me? God is not in control. If he's not providentially the God of providence, he's not the one ruling and overruling, then how can he be the one I can build my life on? And the whole point that you see in Job is Job lost everything, but he had one thing I didn't list in that first list of assets. He had his wife. He was going to lose his health, but he had his wife and his life, and he had his God, and he knew God. And that's what he held on to his entire life. And I know people pick on Job's wife, but I don't happen to think badly of her. She saw her husband suffering, and she said to him, curse God and die. And people say, oh, that's terrible. She was a terrible... You know, I have been on the bedside of people dying of cancer. And I have seen, I've been the recipient of this request. Pastor, please pray that the Lord will take them home. I can't take the pain. That's what she was doing. Curse God and die. I would point this out. You know when he got done and God doubled all his blessings? You know what he had? The same wife. She had the second family. He didn't replace her wife. She was not a bad person. She was a loving wife, and I think we have to not forget that. But anyway, that's a different sermon. I got to quit preaching that sermon, preach this one. When we recognize God's overriding providence in our lives, we need to accept it. And that, I think, is key. You know, one of the things that James is going to shoot at, we were going through James in Sunday school, so I think of James a lot. But in James chapter 4, he talks about those people that make all these plans. And people preach on that and say, well, God's against plans. He's not against plans. He's against plans without him. You make plans, and you should, you need to let him blue pencil those plans if he wants to. And we have to say, well, if the Lord wills. In other words, we have to accept the fact that we can do this if God says that we should do that. He wants us to do it. That it's his will. That's the key part. So that's accepting it. We have to accept his blue pencil when he wants to do it. Finally, we must never take what God has said lightly. You know, you see that with Isaac. God had said to Isaac through Rebecca, what he said to Rebecca is this: the younger is going to serve the older, which is a pattern, by the way, in the Old Testament. God does that a lot. The one who doesn't deserve it's the one who's going to get it. And that's called grace. It's a picture for us. But the point is, God doesn't say anything, and what he says we shouldn't take lightly. He doesn't say anything just to beat his gums. There's a couple of verses, and I put this in just so we think about this, but the wages of sin is death. That's true. God will judge all sin. And then he's also said, as many as received him, to them he gave the authority to become the children of God, the sons of God, even to them that believe in his name. That also is true. That's the hope of our salvation, is that his word is true. And that's the important thing. So I hope as we think about Isaac, this almost invisible man in the Old Testament, we think about not only that he rebelled against God, but his faith when the rebellion came out. He gave a blessing that involved things he didn't have in his hand. It was things to come. And he believed God would do it. And when he realized that God had countermanded what he did, he accepted it. He understood that God had given Isaac the blessing. The blessing belonged to him, and he didn't stand in the way of that. A different point of view, maybe, but it's one that I think is the point of Hebrews chapter 11.